Good afternoon, thank you all for coming. On behalf of our board members who, as you see, worked very hard to make today's event reality, thanks so much for coming to today's event entitled The Economic Crisis, Wall Street, Main Street, or K Street. The financial meltdown that we're experiencing today is easily the greatest one since the Great Depression in our country, and it's hijacked a presidential campaign that just a few months ago everyone probably would have thought was going to be based on terrorism, national security, and maybe a couple of ministers in the president's backyard. And now all we hear about is subprime mortgages, government-sponsored entities, and mortgage-backed securities. Words that your average Sarah Hockey mom or Joe Sixpack probably would not have known they were a couple months ago. And Bill Plummer, that's right. And if you would have asked them what's Fanny and Freddy, they probably would have said it's the next cartoon from DreamWorks Animation. So obviously there's a lot of questions that people have. Some may say trace it back to the failure of the first Wall Street Bank when Lehman failed after 158 years on Wall Street. Some may go back to the Community Investment Act New Deal regulation, and some insist it was the deregulation of the original New Deal regulations. And we are honored to have two of the most distinguished authorities today on the one economics to help us understand the crisis, what caused it, and what can be done to stop bleeding with as minimal damage as possible under the circumstances, and what's the government's proper role in this. Professor Richard Epstein is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Professor of Loan Economics at the University of Chicago and Director of the Loan Economics Program at Chicago. Professor Epstein will speak for about 40 minutes, followed by about 10 minutes of commentary by our very own Professor Stephen Dale. And then we'll have a short question and answer session. To remind you all, if anyone hasn't signed up yet for national membership, the booklet's over there, Great Debates, Constitutions, and the latest issue of the Federalist Paper. And just without further ado, it's my honor to introduce Professor Richard Epstein.
It is an honor to be here. Happy to see so many people who have confident judgments about what is right and wrong about this situation. It is, in fact, one of the things that's really quite characteristic about this. Usually people who do economics or law and economics do not lack for confidence when they start to talk about the major problems of our day. And if this were a discourse on the anti-discrimination laws of minimum wage or some similar topic, I would be very strongly in the case or the camp for deregulation. But money and credit and all the rest of this stuff is much more difficult to get a grip on, and so you have to be aware of two extremes and try to find some way between them. Now, this is puts me in an uncharacteristic position of being a moderate, but so be it. I will bear that scorn with whatever dignity I can summon. What are the two extremes that you have to fight against, or at least think hard about? Well, one of them is the strong libertarian position, which says anytime people enter into a financial market or a financial transaction, they know what the risks are, and if it turns out that they're miscalculated, they should be allowed to fail. That's the only way in which you can keep the whole system under equilibrium, because otherwise you're going to have to introduce a massive level of subsidies and distortions of one kind or another, and what you will do is you'll be throwing good money after bad, and the whole situation will be systematically worse than what it has already been. And I think there is some truth to that particular situation. You ought never to ignore it. But I think, on the other hand, the history of the complexities of these interlocking transactions, the dangers that one sees with bank runs, and all sorts of sort of collective phenomena of that sort, caution against the idea that you can apply to many, many, many mass transactions taking place at a single time the same kind of logic that you can apply to isolated or uncorrelated transactions. The two of them don't function in exactly the same way, and so it may well be the kinds of responses that you need are going to differ somewhat. But at the other side, there is the sort of position which is now associated with many on the liberal side of the political spectrum. My friend, say that Barack Obama is somebody who says that the source of all evil in the credit markets has been the, quote, massive amount of deregulation that has taken place. If you want the acerbic version of this, the recent issue of Slate has a feature by Jacob Weisberg, who basically calls all libertarians immature intellectuals, a term which came very dear to my heart, who are fixated on the novels of Ayn Rand, and so therefore ought to be utterly disqualified, and that the case for regulation is so self-evident that anybody who wants to stand in the way of it is simply going to repeat and create greater doings. This basic attitude towards folks like me, you've done enough homework, sit down, shut up, and be quiet, and let the limited folks instead take over the general economy. I have to tell you, when I deal with the libertarian side of this thing, I'm trying to figure out my way to a correct answer. When I have to deal with criticisms like the ones that you sometimes see on the left, these sort of, all I want to do is read, because it quite indicates that in situations of major peril, certain amounts of name-calling seem to take over. And that what you need to do is to get back and to figure out how it is that this whole system is put together. Now, in order to explain it, and it is very difficult to explain, but one has to do is to start thinking about the system as though it's some kind of a patient, and that you are now some kind of a financial doctor. And the metaphor that I like to use about this is that if you go to medicine, it turns out that the diagnosis of conditions is in fact quite difficult, and many times people have been killed because they need an upper and they're given a downer, because it may well be that the underlying physiology of a particular ailment may be quite different, even though the two manifestations of it may be quite similar. And so you have to be able to be extremely astute in figuring out the causes so that you don't aggravate the problem instead of solving it. But the second point that we have to have, is there something wrong with this microphone? Okay, now it's close enough. The second problem that you have with respect to all of these situations is simply because you can make a diagnosis doesn't mean in the slightest that you actually can propose something that looks like a cure. The medical analogy is sometimes we now have diagnosed you with terminal cancer, and if that turns out to be the horrific result, what we're saying is no amount of human ingenuity can reverse the natural biological processes. And there are certain kinds of societies that get themselves into sufficient tailspins that it's probably the case that no form of financial intervention that we have will be sufficient unto the day. The usual forms of intervention that you have are those which call for some kind of a government bailout or saving, and the theory is that the ship of state will always be above the water, notwithstanding the fact that it's taking on extra baggage by its various obligations. But as we know, you can constantly slip slower and lower into the water, and then you get to that awkward point where all of a sudden, that one additional straw not only breaks the camel's back, but to mix a metaphor, it also sinks the entire ship. And so that one can never think about government intervention under these circumstances as something which doesn't create additional systematic risks of its own, which is one of the reasons why it is that the entire problem to solve has the kind of complexity that it has. There is no risk-free alternative that is available to us. And one of the things I like to stress on this particular problem is that in the effort to control various forms of limited and localized risk with some kind of a general and comprehensive government solution, you are systematically increasing the probability of a much larger risk, which may be low, but as it starts getting bigger, you have to multiply and realize that a low probability of an enormous risk may in fact be far greater than a high probability of a somewhat smaller one. So how then do you start to do with this on the diagnosis side? I think the first point that I would want to make about how you understand the way in which markets work is to say that in the world in which we live today, there is no such thing as a private market transaction, no matter how much you would like to make it such. And this calls attention to a feature of most business transactions that we'd like to neglect, which is the role of money in the way in which we organize voluntary sales. Now, in the good old days, the origin of money essentially took in the following form. People would have something like gold, and what they would do is they would want to store it for safekeeping, and what they would receive in exchange was a certificate that allowed them to redeem their gold upon presentation. And then this became money, and the certificate became freely alienable from hand to hand, and what you then had to do was to make sure that people could not fraudulently counterfeit these various kinds of receipts. You'd make them a little bit more a little bit more complicated, and when they circulate in society, the great advantage of having this fixed store and making sure that there's no counterfeiting is that people know that the supply of the currency turns out to be fixed, and so therefore it is relatively free from various forms of government manipulation. Now, there are difficulties, however, with this, because if you tie your monetary supply to a commodity like gold, and gold itself is subject to fluctuations based upon external situations, it may well be that you can't, as it were, inflate the currency by adding more of these certificates of deposit into the mix. But if the underlying thing tends to be worth less or more on alternative days, you lose stability from another dimension, that of valuation fluctuations, which in fact will make these private transactions much more difficult. So what happens in most modern societies, and it's a mixed result, is people say, look, we cannot figure out how to make a commodity-based monetary system work. What we have to do is to get ourselves a government currency. And if we go back to the origins, the first efforts of government currencies were always to try and have the government hold the gold in Fort Knox or at the New York Federal Reserve Bank or something of the sort, and they still keep supplies of it. But sooner or later, the amount of the commodity as a fraction of the total amount of wealth in the society shrinks. And so you're going to have certificates that are not going to be backed by gold. And therefore, you must find some other way to limit the amount of these certificates that move, because otherwise, in fact, you're going to be trying to put in pricing terms into various contracts where the ruler itself will not be constant. And this is not a small difficulty to deal with. Many of you have heard about the Great Depression, which Ruben referred to a moment ago. Most people, when they hear about the Great Depression, do not know about the Great Deflation in the Great Depression, which triggered so much of the difficulties. Quite simply, under that stalwart Herbert Hoover, and then later under Roosevelt, the money supply was allowed to contract, so that every debt denominated in fixed dollars was much more costly to pay off than had previously been the case. This prompted all sorts of difficulties in the foreclosure market, which in turn prompted all sorts of efforts to create a moratorium. And of course, that sounds wonderful. Keep the debtors on the premises because they can't possibly pay the debt, and the banks would be just fine. Of course, the banks don't get the money. They're not so fine. All of a sudden, their depositors understand that they're not going to be able to redeem. The nervousness starts to take place, and once that takes place, there's a run on the bank. And in fact, when I attended a securities regulation conference to try to talk about this bailout a couple of weeks ago here at NYU Law School, I was introduced to a phrase which was quite chilling, which indicates that this risk is not one that's going to disappear today. And somebody said, you know that the major money market funds were running the risk of breaking the buck. And I looked at them and I said, I don't even know what that means, which shows you how much wisdom I have on this subject. But once somebody defines the term to you, not only do you know what it means, but it means that there's no safe place to keep your money. Because what breaking the buck means is that you put your money into these various accounts, and the rule is that you can redeem it at par at any time that you want, a dollar for a dollar. If, in fact, the money goes into commercial paper, which itself depreciates in value, there is now a risk on a run on Fidelity, and breaking the buck means that the company will say, there's so much money that is being demanded of us that we can only redeem you at 99 or 98 or 97 cents on the dollar. And the moment you break the buck and you go down below that par level, it's quite clear that a rush to the exit can easily take place, and the redemptions could be at much, much lower levels. What this suggests is that there's a very low probability of an absolutely dislocating event because people thought their money was quote-unquote safe in these things, which were substitutes for saving deposits of one kind or another. But they're not. And in fact, one of the reasons why this current financial situation is so totally neurotic is that at the present time, given the various bailout strategies, we do not know whether we have to fear a deflation or an inflation. It could be either or both that take place in fairly rapid succession. And generally speaking, your ability to price all sorts of transactions becomes weaker and weaker as the level of uncertainty with respect to the basic money supply starts to increase. So there's reason for the enormous uneasiness about Wall Street. But you have to understand there is no safety. You can't get it in commercial paper and you cannot get it in cash because it's quite possible on the cash side. It'll be one-to-one redemption. But the valuation risk that we were talking about before continue to come back so that the dollar, in fact, will pay you nothing by way of interest and will depreciate 5 to 7% a year by virtue of some kind of rapid inflation or more. The basic model that I have of this is from Sartre's Play No Exit. It turns out there is no dominant strategy that is available to anyone, public or private, to insulate yourself from the risks in question. When you have major contractions in the total level of sort of physical and intellectual property wealth in this country, or intangible wealth, there is no way that somebody can say, I wish to take a risk-free position, so I'm going to do X. You still have to diversify against the set of risks which you normally don't think is being brought into play, but in fact are being brought into play at the present time. So this is not a real optimistic story, in case you haven't caught my drift. The question then is, what happened in this case? Well, as I indicated to you, the moment you have a financial transaction, if the money variation is not secure, then in effect people will have the wrong signals in which they exchange goods. So the usual libertarian argument, which I heartily endorse, with stable money, underlying, voluntary exchange is the greatest mechanism for wealth creation in the history of the world, is true. But if in fact you screw up the ruler, then every single voluntary transaction has a gratuitous form of uncertainty. The great achievement of Milton Friedman, a name which has been taken in vain too often lately, was not so much his stuff about proselytizing free market economics generally. It was his work in monetary theory, a quintessential government area, where he was able to devise a set of protocols which essentially allowed you to expand the money supply to keep pace with the increase in the level of goods, so that instead of having the deflations that you had in the 1930s and the inflations that you had in the 1970s, we've had since about 1980 or 82 relatively constant money rates. And this means, in effect, that one element of security or uncertainty in these transactions is eliminated. So that's the first point, I think, that one wants to get across. The second thing is that the government gets involved not only in defining the money supply, which is, in fact, I regard as an issue in this case, but also in setting the general interest rates at which banks can borrow. And what happens is we know that basically the real rate of money is somewhere around 2%, maybe 3% for risk-free investments. And when you start having the federal funds rate going down at 1 or 1.5 or whatever it is, and that's going to be adjusted for risk down the road, what you do is you're essentially putting too much money into the system, because you're not charging people the full amount for the money that they have to have. That means, in effect, that they're going to take too much of this stuff, this new money, and they're going to put it into various kinds of durable assets, call them homes, which are secured by mortgages, and with these very cheap and easy rates. And what happens is there's only so long that you can continue to pump the pump, you know, prime the pump by putting all this extra money in the system, because the more you do that, you now start running a very serious inflation risk. But the moment you start to cut back, what happens is the refinancing options that were given to people who borrowed beyond their means with short-term paper, which was the standard pattern, are much more limited, and they are now going to have to refinance at a higher rate, which will in fact lead to certain kinds of default. It also turns out at the same time, and this is synergistic with the first thing, we have a very determined group on the liberal side in the Senate and the House. Barney Frank, I think, is the chief culprit. The word was culprit. This is for the camera, in this case, trying to sponsor subsidized mortgages coming through Fannie and Freddie Mac. And that this turns out to say, look, we are really going to encourage people to buy a house very little by way of down payment and very high mortgage percentages at interest rates which are not going to be sustainable. It's just asking for trouble. Now, how will private enterprise respond to all of this? And this is something I think that libertarians understand very well, which is that any time you have a government stimulus, in this case the excessive willingness to loan and subsidies, private markets will aggravate and expand and magnify the error. That's the danger. You go back to the sort of basic model of individual self-interest, and when you're dealing with anonymous financial transactions, don't worry about the natural love and affection that everybody has for his niece or his dog. These things just don't matter in these cases. It's the self-interest model that really starts to apply on an individual basis. And you are now telling somebody who's in a bank that what you have to do is to lend this money to somebody, collect the fee, and don't worry about the creditworthiness of the borrower, because you could lend against the government guarantee or the government obligation to repurchase. And the moment you create this situation, we know it is a wealth destruction mechanism of unparalleled significance because of the way in which the whole thing is put together. So somebody makes a loan on a property, and the day the paper comes back into its hands, its market value is 80 cents. That is, means he managed to lose 20% on day one. No matter, you can now sell it off to a government guy or to somebody else who has a government guarantee who's going to be able to receive 100 cents on the dollar. At that particular point, people will lend against the guarantee or the repurchase obligation. They will not lend against the security of the property. So that all of the restraints that you would have to place on private parties in a market of scarcity are no longer going to be put into situation. And we know what happens with respect to bubbles. First guy does it and it works fine. the government says, well, you know, let's have another good idea. And everybody thinks the functions are linear. That is, you can increase it a little bit more, everything will get a little bit better. Nothing will ever flip over on you and kill you. So we go do this at an accelerating rate, and then sure enough, at the end, we come to the point where somebody cannot resell or not refinance, and the whole house of cards starts to come tumbling down in virtue of the fact that the easy money, high subsidy programs that are involved. The government guarantees are involved, but at the same time, these government guarantees now enable and help to prosper another kind of market, which is of equal importance, which is the so-called securitization market. Now, most of you probably have not heard of securitization until recently, and some of you may not have the slightest idea of what the whole thing means. But essentially, the original idea with securitization was that we have to make sure we don't fall prey to the same kinds of serious dislocations that we had in the mortgage markets during the 1980s. It started off in the early years of the 80s, and by the end of the decade, you had a full-blown S&L crisis in these things. And quite simply, it's this. If somebody originates loans and holds all of those loans in its bank portfolio, if there's some local blip in the economy, Lockheed closes in Los Angeles or whatever, all of the properties in that particular area are going to suffer some kind of financial decline, so that if you're a lender on those particular mortgages without diversification in your portfolio, what will happen will be that you will suffer very bad hits, and your whole bank will become essentially at risk. So banks quickly learned that lesson, and the lesson they learned from it is that you must get rid of the paper that you hold into a larger market where, in fact, it can be bundled up with loans that were originated in other areas, so that the bad luck that you have in California can, with respect to the pool, be offset by the good luck that's happening in Arizona, or vice versa. So the diversification was thought to be a powerful way to handle that problem, and securitization was one step. But once you get these bundles, the question is, how do you then sell them out to the market? And people realized that there were gains from trade by taking these mortgages and dividing them into what they call tranches, so that some people would be very secure and get the first dollars coming out of the pool, and other people would be in a much riskier position, essentially bearing the brunt of the original default. And all of these ways in which you slice these mortgages were made possible by virtue of the fact that modern computer programs were capable of following and essentially marking and tracing all of the permutations with respect to the dollars, so that no matter where the money came in, you always knew where it was supposed to be shoveled, which is a great achievement. This is no small thing to do. It led to a strong amount of standardization with respect to mortgages, because unless you have the standardization, you cannot engage in the kinds of pooling activity. But here again, it's another version of the point that I made before. Diversification is a much more complicated concept than people would have thought. And it turns out that certain strategies that allow you to diversify against some risks, in fact, make it impossible for you to diversify against others, and indeed create a greater set of problems. So what happens is, when you start to securitize these things, the local variations in property no longer are going to bring you down. But any kind of national policy that you have, which impacts all of these securitized packages of mortgages simultaneously, now has the rare capability of bringing the whole thing down. And it's one of the things that private markets are often not very good at doing, which is anticipating the way in which regulation will impact upon them. Whether you want to call this a failure of markets or a failure of government regulation is a terminological point which has a lot of ideological freight, but at this point I'm more interested in understanding the description of the situation rather than trying to make some sort of normative judgment as to where we point the finger. And what's the quote-unquote culprit in this particular case? It's an effort to secure various kinds of transparency with respect to these packages. One of the things that happens when you create these securitized interests is that they then become the basis for further transactions, as people can buy against them or borrow against them or use them as security for various kinds of loans. That is one of the great geniuses of a market system, is that anything that you buy, you can resell. But it turns out, as you start to do this, you can enter into certain very complicated transactions, credit default swaps, for example, which essentially are contracts that are bet on the soundness of the underlying portfolio. In order for those contracts to be accurately priced, you have to be able to price the stuff that's gone into them. And the difficulty that you have with respect to this in the mortgage market is that these are long-term assets broken up into short-term pieces, subject to real fluctuation as a function not only of local conditions, but also of government regulation. What's the government regulation that makes the difference in this case, which helps explain the problem? It's an obscure set of rules invoked both in loan covenants and by SEC rule, I believe. It's called the mark-to-market phenomenon. And this was the thing which happened to create immense dislocations in the late 1980s in the SNL business, and it comes back to happen again. As with many forms of public regulation, this one was essentially defended on the grounds that it would increase transparency by forcing people to make clear on their portfolios what their portfolios were worth, even if they had not made a sale. How many of you have had income tax? I don't know, but just a show of hands. All right, they're not enough, so I'm going to have to give you the short-term version of the income tax plan. You own a capital asset on your particular books for which you paid $100. And the whole thing now is worth $50 in terms of its appreciation. And the question is, how do you put this thing on your balance sheet for tax purposes? Do you force somebody to recognize the gain on the $50 without the asset being sold? Or do you allow them to carry it at book value and make no changes? And for the most part, in a tax purpose situation, we allow the regulation or the taxation of the gain to be deferred until you have the realization event, that is, the sale of the property in question. You get in your $150 or whatever, you subtract out the original cost with a certain number of adjustments, and now you have your gain or loss. But in many cases, particularly when you're dealing with loan portfolios, this kind of deferment of the revaluation of the asset is not going to work if the amount of money that you have in your particular bank has to be assayed in order to figure out whether or not you meet reserve requirements in order to retain the bank, or meet the requirements that are required in loan covenants in order to prevent the default taking place. So you need to worry about some mechanism for intermediate reevaluation. Mark-to-market sought to apply them. And again, the lesson that you learn is that, like with bank runs, any particular technique that may work fairly well with respect to uncorrelated transactions, in which there's a relatively low level of failure, will work quite horribly when it turns out that there's a positive correlation between these various events, so that genuine kinds of cascades can take place and bring the whole system down. And that's essentially what happened in some of these areas. As one of my students at NYU reminded me, he said, look, every one of the banks, investment banks that failed on Wall Street were cash flow positive at the time they were going down, which meant they were taking in more money than they were paying out with respect to their obligations. So there was some sign of shall we say, that they were able to meet their obligations in the short run. This is not normally regarded as a sign of terrible trouble, because you have sort of physical and observable behavior that something may be well with the system. But the moment you have mark-to-market coming in there, you're no longer trying to evaluate the company by seeing the flows in and the flows out, figuring out the difference, and worrying about what it's going to look like in the future. What somebody is requiring you to do is to take one of these assets and mark-to-market. Now, you can mark in one of two ways. If you mark up, the asset, the interest rates have gone down, the asset's worth a little bit more than you thought about it, that's fine. Nobody's going to go bankrupt by being told by the government that they have to declare themselves to be rich. And in fact, what mark-to-market under those circumstances does is it increases the sort of perceived value of the situation, and it paves the way for having greater amounts of loans on the one hand or larger capital requirements in the banking system on the other. So it's a kind of a stimulus. But the downside is not symmetric. Because what happens is, if somebody looks at this portfolio and divines, under circumstances that we really don't know, that you're marking to a market that nobody can observe, because you don't really have one of these things, that loan which you thought was worth $100 is now worth $75, it's not just one loan you got like that, it's the whole portfolio that is looking at this particular situation. They'll say, you know, congratulations, you think you're making money, but if you look at the underlying assets, your liabilities exceed your assets, and so therefore you're now insolvent. And the only way that you can solve this particular problem is to dump some of these uncertain securities, get cash, whatever that is, in exchange for it, so as to build up the reserve requirements so that you continue to operate. But now remember, you're in an environment which everything is positively correlated with everything else, and the moment you start to sell this stuff, your very act of selling creates an additional pressure on the market. So you may have been valued at 75. The moment you start going in and selling, it goes down to 70 because you've got this overhang on the market. Well, that's great. Then you look at bank number two, which was solvent at a valuation of 75. You now have this market transaction under distressed circumstances, which is running the level at 70. And so now they're insolvent as well. And what you can do is get yourself an absolutely perfect cascade. This is a very serious problem. And so you start throwing people over the cliff by marking to a market which you change by virtue of the very rule that you have. It's kind of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle with a vengeance. The mere effort to try to measure what your level of insolvency is aggravates the insolvency beyond all parts of reason with respect to the underlying transaction. This is not a laughing matter. And so then somebody comes up to you and you say, well, what's the alternative? There's the rub. It's not so easy to figure out what the alternative is to a mark-to-market system. Because if you don't do any kind of marking in any kind of way, then in effect, the uncertainty about the relationship between book values or inherited values 6 months ago and the current value of the portfolio will still create certain kinds of difficulties. That is, the fragmentation of the interest through the system of securitization means that transparency is harder to achieve. And not only that, since you've got so many part owners in this thing, even if you figured out that you had to do something, it's very difficult to work a renegotiation of the terms so that you can figure out what it is that you have to do. So what happens is, I think the private market essentially overestimated its ability to deal with these risks, and the one that it could not handle was the government situation. My own sense, and I'd like to speak to some bankers who maybe even help me on this, is that if, in fact, we did not have mark-to-market and we still had the need for transparency, what I think would have happened is there would have emerged a market of discrete intermediaries, clearinghouse types, or something of the sort, who would get this information, share it with those people who needed to know in order to make the transactions, and try to treat it as a proprietary trade secret in an effort to keep sure that the markets would be lubricated. That's my sense as to what might have happened, which would, of course, have been a much better result than the one that we have here. But you've got to make sure that you can figure out what to do. So now if you're trying to figure out why it is that the libertarian principle is not as great as we would want, I think you've got two explanations for it. One of them is it's quite clear that the herd behavior that you observe in these particular cases creates systematic externalities with respect to everybody else. And if you can figure out a way to stop that, which makes improvements across the board, no libertarian wants to take the position that we're in favor of suicide packs. I mean, I'm tired of some extreme libertarians saying, you know, want to have writing requirements and contracts under the statute of frauds? That's a form of government regulation that interferes with freedom of contract. Off with your head. If people want to have oral agreements, let them do it. Try telling that to the real estate business. They'll kill you. Essentially, what happens in these situations is that the government role has long been and properly been understood that it's designed to stabilize the security of transactions by making enforcement work at the back end. If you can figure out a way to do that in these markets, whether they be the underwritten mortgage markets or whatever, by all means be my guest and try to do it. And here the government came up with two possibilities for handling this situation. And neither of them are crazy. And both of them, I think, are consistent with a small government approach. One of them is you buy the worst paper and take it out of the bank so their balance sheets are restored in a certain way by getting rid of what you now call toxic loans. This is not easy to do because you don't want to take them to zero. And on the other hand, you don't want to pay an enormous premium. But the original purpose of the bailout was quite simply this. We will take some of these things. We will pay you more than you could get on mark to market because we think the discounted value of the future cash flows are worth more than that number, for which there is good empirical evidence to believe that it is true. And then you have to set that middle number. So that just simply taking it out of private hands, putting it into government hands, means that what you have done, at least in the short run, is to create a situation where the downward spiral of forced sales will affect in. And this is a way of trying to control the panic. It doesn't have any multiplier effect, however, in the sense that you still got this stuff around, it doesn't get rid of the liquidity crisis that the banks have to face, and so the Europeans first and then later even the United States came along. And what we decided to do is essentially to inject some money into the banks to offset the loss of capitalization. That doesn't require you to make valuations of individual assets toxic or otherwise, but it does require you to make a valuation of what this particular share in the bank is worth as a percentage of the company as a whole. And you have to decide what the form of the holding is going to be. Is it going to be simply common stock, a preferred stock, some kind of voting preferred, non-voting preferred, convertible preferred? One of the things that anybody who's done corporate finance knows is that the number of ways in which you can divide a given pool of assets by putting share and debt claims on it is potentially infinite. And it actually takes some real technical expertise to figure out what that optimal capital structure is. So now you see why it's always between a rock and a hard place. you want to buy this stuff up, you've got valuation problems that don't quit and positive effects that are limited, you want to make the injections, you have to answer all the business judgment questions, which we don't have good ones, on how much goes in, who gets it, and what's the form of the holdings that take place. All one can say about this is doing something is probably better than doing nothing. Now, so what is it that the libertarian has to say? I'm going to sort of end on this note so that Steve can give some comment. What you want to say about this is twofold. One is the thing that you learn most from this sort of situation is, in effect, the never again maxim. Once you see the hell that is created with cheap money and subsidized mortgages, it is not beyond the capacity of governments, even in a democratic administration, to say, we're just not going to go down this path again. But if you don't understand the origins of this stuff, you will go down this path again. So right now you have calls for additional stimulus packages, which are basically as useful to the market as stock dividends are in ordinary corporate transactions. It just creates uncertainty and it doesn't generate any wealth. So they haven't learned very much on this, which is one reason to be bad. The second thing to understand about these characters is that they cannot resist making the bailout a public choice financing. And if you looked at the bailout that the House voted down on that first Monday, it was about 4 or 5 pages, I've been told. By the time it passed on Friday, it was 500 pages, 490 of which had nothing to do with the bailout, as best one can tell. Because what happened is every congressman came up and said, look, I'll vote for this bailout if you'll do the following thing for my favorite project. And so we start sinking the effectiveness of the bailout by tying it into everything else. My favorite illustration of this is that these yokels managed to create mental health parity in insurance markets by tying that to the bailout bill, where the parity means that anybody who wants to issue insurance against physical injuries now has to do it against the mental health stuff. Anybody who's ever been in the business understands that there are two different risks to insure, and all this is going to do is create more on insurance and make it very clear that, for example, the Obama promise, which says, if you like the health care you have, keep it. Remember that? You all believe it. Well, that's a lie. The reason it cannot be true is you've already changed the health plan that they've had, not by telling people they can't have it, but by lauding on another mandate. So what's happened is, in an effort to create the bailout, we now engage in systematic collective actions of wealth destruction, in my judgment, by interfering with markets and insurance, where they actually do work pretty well, and they don't have any of these problems. So this is a very serious issue. Because essentially what happens is we have now gotten ourselves into a collective frame of mind where the bailout is enigmatic of a zillion other so-called market failures. And once we now realize that it's legitimate to regulate with respect to the bailout, we now say it's legitimate to regulate with respect to anything in which it turns out we have a market failure defined as a situation where the price at which goods are often in a competitive market exceed the amount that some people are able to pay for it, so that all competitive markets now have systematic market failure. So what is it that we have to do? We have to learn how to focus. We have to recognize that the monetary system and the price system and so forth, and the subsidy system, are in fact government-created public goods, which require government regulation. But the rest of this stuff is something which you have to understand is that it's still pork. And it's still the kind of stuff that you don't want to do. Or if you do want to do it, you want to have a full and complete debate about it, going through separate channels instead of treating it as a rider for what is happening. And one of the things that libertarians are not very good at is understanding the public choice failures of collective institutions. And that's what you have to stress. And so what you are watching now is, I think, a very powerful pathology overtaking all the situation. And it's an open question as to whether or not we will pile enough stuff onto this particular raft that we will sink the entire operation as opposed to simply a few financial institutions. Think back to the good old days where all you worried about was Bear Stearns.
Thank Thanks, Richard. Richard was, I understand, first going to speak with you about con law, and Dean Traynor was going to respond and was unable to because in the tradition of public service that is our law school, he's doing jury duty today. So we had to change topics, and Richard was able to. But like the dean, I wanted to give him a present. I was going to give him some Fordham flip-flops, but I apparently have the last pair, but I have that new Fordham hat.
Hey! It's too small for my swelling.
Somehow, I did not set it that way.
Well, this is just a subtle hint. Big enough to fit into four.
Arrowhead
is immovable. It's like one of the seven rocks of granite.
Somebody got that reference.
Too. No, they didn't. That's
I got that. That's
I know you
were. So I'm billed as a communist today, and I take that in the sort of flattering way that communist has come to be used by conservatives lately. That is to say, I will have some reasonable suggestions. First, I think Richard and I find it embarrassing that it seems part of our financial crisis is a sort of cascade problem, that people have gotten upset, that there's a panic, some kind of collective action that I'm surprised at, that if assets really are being sold for less than they're worth, why isn't somebody stepping up to buy? If this mortgage paper is worth only 70 cents on the dollar, why can't they sell it? I mean, why aren't there people out there doing it? But I think we probably agree, and it seems that many people agree that that's not working, and on the risk that it is not working, that we have to do something about it. What I want to ask, though, is what gets us into this? And I don't think that I'm not confident that it was either government pressure to make loans on people who couldn't afford them for houses, nor that mark-to-market accounting was the trigger for this cascade. And I think we're wrong about what those are, that it's that we can get the wrong prescription here. So the subprime mortgages, in part, were mortgages to poor people, but they were also mortgages to wealthy people who were buying million-dollar houses and people who couldn't prove their creditworthiness. And the government wasn't forcing anybody to do those, and those are many of the failures. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac aren't really involved in those. Instead, I think what you've got was a set of mortgages in which the lender was long. Bank was long on real estate. So long as real estate went up, everything would work. The borrower would pay his interest for 2 years, refinance as prices had risen in 2 years, take out a lot of money, and would be able to shift away from a very risky mortgage to a standard mortgage. So everything works fine while prices are going up, and surely the banks knew that. The banks knew that this would work while prices were going up and would fail to work if prices stabilized, let alone fell. The people who were buying these loans knew the same thing. People who put these things into portfolios, people who invested in those portfolios, always knew, it was fairly clear, that subprime loans depended for payback on prices going up. They failed to go up, and then you have problems. But oftentimes, banks and others make loans that aren't going to be paid off. And the failure of the internet bubble or solar power or anything else doesn't lead to this incredible contraction of the market. So what about this failure is different leads to a contraction of lending markets? Now, is it mark-to-market? If mark-to-market accounting for financial firms doesn't really reflect what they're worth, shouldn't people who are investing or lending to them or borrowing from them or managing them simply ignore it? If the accounting is misleading, if it shows that their assets are worth very little, just ignore it. You know, in fact, that they're worth more. Now, it doesn't work for regulation. If a regulator says you can't make loans if your capital is too low because of mark-to-market, that's a problem. But a lot of people who are having problems now aren't in that situation. These lenders are not prohibited from making loans because their capital is inadequate, because artificially depressed by mark-to-market. They're not making loans because they don't want to make loans. People simply don't know what the situation of their counterparties are. And so what I want to offer is something that Richard also said. That is the incredible complexity of the situation and lack of transparency. That securitization, which allowed for the spreading of loans, also created instruments that nobody could look through. If you take a set of loans, you put it into one portfolio, divide that portfolio, put it into a second portfolio, divide that, put it into a third, on and on and on. At some point, people own things that it's literally impossible for anybody to figure out what you own and figure out how risky that is. And so at some point, then once risk is in the system, that market prices for houses are falling, that some things are defaulting, it's impossible for anybody who owns those assets to know how much they're going to get in the end. This is not some mark-to-market problem. It's just impossible because of the opaque character to know what the assets are worth. So now, at that point, anybody lending to somebody else doesn't know whether they can pay. And that turns out to be a problem across the board. And so what you've created, I think, what I wonder, is whether the free market created incredibly complicated, as you put it, and also opaque instruments that destroy transparency, and once they become widespread, make it very difficult for people to work among themselves. So if that's the problem, at least the way to prevent it in the future is perhaps to insist on a great deal more transparency. I think that we would probably evolve towards a clearinghouse system, that will happen, that the voluntary participants will do it, but if they don't, it seems I have no problem with the government pushing them towards that kind of transparency, because apparently they can't do everything perfectly. And we shouldn't over-regulate, but the transparency is the problem. And that we have a system in a complicated world. We shouldn't count on transparency being a naturally arising attribute of free markets. And so I think that Richard agrees that transparency may be the solution. I ask whether the transparency ought not to be, whether the government should have been pressing for transparency before. I also want to congratulate him on noting that the Democrats presented a four-page proposal to save the banks, and then in order to bring, and the sad story that in order to bring those Republicans on, you had to have 500 more pages of buying dresses for the vice president. So I guess
to be
or not to be.
So I guess
I want to ask that: have we learned from this that the markets can't be counted upon? That it's reasonable to have government regulation for transparency. I think you're in favor of government regulation for avoiding fraud. Is this some sort of a kicker on fraud for transparency? Other than that, I agree entirely.
Well, can I make a couple of responses? I mean, the communists and the libertarian now come together. There are two problems that I have with Steve's approach, and they're not meant as criticism. They're just meant as an effort to show just how difficult this whole thing is. I mean, the first thing is, once we say we're in favor of regulation, pray tell, what does that regulation look like? What you have to understand about the derivative markets is that these things are written off contracts, but they have no particular physical location or place. And so you could write a derivative contract on an American mortgage in Ireland with a Greek counterpart. And so if you regulate so much domestically and the stuff goes offshore, you're going to have serious problems, which means that global solutions become sort of more desirable, at which point I think we now are going to be subject to the Christmas tree effect again in another way, because you won't get global regulations unless you give subsidies to poor people from different nations, and you're off to the races again in the same point. So it's not as though when one's in favor of regulation, you know what to do. My sense is, and I think Steve would agree with this, is the best thing you can do is to nudge people in the direction of private clearinghouses, because those things can be extraterritorial in a way in which government regulation cannot. And essentially what a clearinghouse is there's a guy in the middle who's making sure that these changes match up, who's taking some residual risk if he can't clear the market on both sides. That's the way I understand it. And how that works in this market is going to be there, and it may well be that you will now find that the ability to get the third generation derivative sold is going to be much worse. The second point is a modest disagreement, which is it's quite right that the subprime market was one and all entries. But I think it's wrong to assume that by virtue of the fact that you have some of these things in an unregulated market and some of them in a regulated market, that you want to treat the two of them as independent. I think what really happens in this situation is you start bundling assets and you have this level of transparency that goes down. The moment you get the forced sales in one side of the market, there are going to be ripple effects in the other side of the market, which will exaggerate the whole situation. So it's not as though there's a direct or sole or exclusive cause of taking place, but I think the general loss of market confidence, you know, the series of uninformed consumers and hedge fund types and everything else, you will not be able to get the segregation in response to figuring out who's going to do what, and you'll see a general decline, which is further than you have, simply because of the same point he said. If you don't have very clear information as to what's in each bundle, once you start seeing things going down, you take the prophylactic effort and you get the flight to cash into certainty, and that creates a cascade on both sides of the market. So this is a very killer, hard problem to deal with, and you know, that's why I said a little bit of humility goes a long way here, And what I, all I can say on the government side is if you avoid the subsidies, you reduce the probability of a recurrence. This is not to say that it's the sole cause, right, which it is. But it's not to say, on the other hand, it's completely phenomenal. And so what you do is you want to become a kind of a classical liberal rather than a hardline libertarian. We should open up the question.
Shella has a mic there. She's in the room.
I think you do.
Yeah, I'm close enough.
Yeah. I think she's a question. It's a nice way that you don't have to call me. I think he's the first question now.
I have
Somebody has to have a question.
just raise your hand. So this
Can you? Matt's got to do it. Matt's got to take a question.
Steve is going to take charge. He's the homeboy.
It seems to me that you mentioned how the middlemen would sort of provide a service that was missing here, and that could have fixed that could fix the markets in the future, and that could have sort of prevented it. But it seems to me that the middlemen sort of bungled it in the first place, the way that they rated these tranches of mortgages and how that they seem to be misrated. A lot of these were like AAA rated or AA rated, when in fact they were much lower quality of mortgages. And of course, once one group of these things start defaulting, then everybody else comes to this cascade. So, for example, the company, AIG, which is a very good insurance company, and most of the company ran pretty well in this particular area, and they were very big in the credit swap, which is essentially an insurance product. They either didn't understand what was happening, or there was enough manipulation here within the free market, which I think the issue is how do you let people who are not transparent and don't explain exactly what this product is. You have a big insurance company who's willing to take all the risk. I mean, nobody put a gun to AIG's head to do it, but it seems that there was just a lack of information, not that you need more regulation, but that the information was not presented properly.
A couple of responses to that question. One is, I think AIG, there's at least some spits of fallout coming from this thing with the change in management and so forth. There's also a regulatory cause of this, which I don't think you want to ignore. The SEC had this crusade that nobody could essentially get information generated which would give preferential to their insiders, right? Now what happens is you can't give preference to your insiders, you have to separate the information generation side from your trading side. You don't get any information at all. And one of Epstein's fundamental theorems is you would rather have slanted information than no information, because if everybody's slanting it, it will mean that you get lots more out there, and it may well be that some guy loses 2% on day one, but the markets will equilibrate much more rapidly. So there was that. Another thing that the SEC did, of course, is it made it impossible for people to buy back their own securities on these things because of fear of market manipulation, so that's a situation which in fact aggravated this problem as well. And the third point that I would make is you talked about rating agencies, and they're not the same as clearinghouses. A rating agency is somebody who doesn't have to take any financial risk when it puts this thing on, and you have the same problems with them that you have with auditors. Be kind to your friends is a real risk. The point about a clearinghouse is there's a middleman in there who, if the market doesn't work right, is in the position of a bookie who has not balanced his portfolio, so that the incentive structure is going to be stronger there than in the other case.
I agree with that, but I want to push further. What was it about this situation that led to AIG making mistaken investments? But the consequence was more than the shareholders of AIG losing their money. That there was this externality that you had to have a financial system. These things are quite important, and I think they're due just by regulation. And I think in the end, I'm not sure what that is, and I recognize it's hard to push. But that's what's novel about these things. When financial analysts talked up the value of energy. And we had the same kind of problem we had there. Lots of people lost money, but we didn't need to elect Barack Obama to solve the problem. Now, of course, we have Barack Obama, but what happens in the day when that's not there?
No, what happens in the day when that's not there? One of the serious issues is he may talk to Paul, but his skill set is as far removed from financial transactions as anything alive. And it's actually a little bit scary. I mean, the alternative, of course, has exactly the same problem associated with it. And Steve and I are quite happy to put on a late election team as the curers, right? Bipartisan. But actually, at this point, our chance of getting a winning coalition in 12 days is not very good.
He talked about the bill that went to Congress with the four-page bill, the 500-page bill. Yeah. It was very interesting that when the vote was actually passed, majority of Republicans, I think, or was pretty close, did not vote for the end, and majority Democrats did.
Oh, he was just making a cheap shot at his Republican.
I'm more of a free market guy in the sense that I was not in favor of the bill at all. What did you see as the outcome had we not passed a bailout bill of $1 billion? Again, that involves the government in more regulation, in more SEC regulation, and the fact where you have private enterprises that probably in the end, the free market probably could have self-corrected.
It may have self, you know, this is one of the standard problems that you have with all the stuff, and I agree with you, is that you have a curve, you're up here, you're going to go down, and you're going to come back up again, it's just a matter of time. The problem is there's a brick wall somewhere between the two things, and the real danger in this case is you'll hit the brick wall before the self-correction mechanisms will kick in. And the alternative scenario, which is not completely improbable, is that the entire world banking system would have collapsed. Not only in the United States, but overseas. Look, it's not as, you know, Bush was very lucky to have Bernanke and Paulson. Can you imagine that guy Snow, who ran a railroad, was still in charge of the Treasury Department at the time that this thing happened? And I have to say, and I know I don't like saying this, but understanding where the problem came and knowing the level of information that I have on the way in which these books of businesses line up, I'm actually going to cut him a little bit of slack on this question, which I will not do when Senator Biden comes forward and says that he wants a windfall profits tax on oil. And the reason is they've got private information about it that we don't have, whereas on the Biden situation, I mean, the man doesn't understand what he's talking about, and there's nothing that you can find in the secret records which will straighten it out. So, you know, you're right to oppose windfall profits tax, and you could do that, but I think in this case, you've got to have a much weaker set of primes. And, you know, the people I respect on both sides of the aisle are often saying, I don't know what's best. And anybody who's ever put a deal together will know that the genius in deal-making is structuring, and that structuring is not a unique situation. These are not competitive markets. Like, you know, put the item on the counter, and the teller will take the cash.
I think that's exactly right. That you got, even I am, as are most socialists these days, inclined to trust
this
the
market. This is a joke. He's a socialist, I'm a communist, fine.
But it is a sense that people who are quite anti-regulation and take the same position of you seem to think there's too much risk of things going wrong. And when the possibility is as disastrous as it was to even
because you can pump, I mean, the biggest worry in my mind, you're talking about the collapse of the world banking system, just is a lack of liquidity to get the money and secure pretty much all these really bad mortgages. But if you just provided the liquidity, and without the
actual... Well, look, I mean, this, I would give you the following answer that you always have to remember. You cannot use a pronoun. We don't know who that you is. And until we find out who that you is, we don't know whether we're in a government or in a non-government world. In fact, that's one of the things that all lawyers always understand is indefinite pronouns without antecedents are not testable propositions.
Yeah, and I would say, if there's a criticism of the program so far, it's still not clear who's going to provide this liquidity. Yeah. The government has given it to the banks, but it hasn't made a plan. That will change in November. But right now, we still may not have solved that problem.
In the back?
Two questions. One, in regard to the rating agencies, obviously, you know, either they should have lowered the ratings for the CMBSs and credit default swap securities.
Collateral mortgage-backed securities for the rest of the world.
Or at least downgraded the major institutions that were backing the securities. Do you think the solution is along what they have to kind of further independence guidelines and things like that? Or do you think we need to create a completely government agency and like make that regulated as, you know, a government sponsor, like regulation in terms of
I think in fact the danger of capture of a government rated agency is even greater. What I'm in favor of, and it seems to have been the case, is more competition in the rating business. This is a highly concentrated industry, and it seems as though there are a fair number of barriers to entry into it. This is very similar to the problem that you have in the auditing function, where after you watch the debacles that take place, now we go forward. And that's just not enough. You can start getting real collusion in markets that have only four.
Yeah, I share that. It's a stretch to say the rating agencies were responsible for all this. To some extent, they made mistakes that were real mistakes, and other people didn't believe this stuff anyway.
And as a former auditor perspective, how do you get around the issue where I found that, you know, there's the auditors don't really evaluate these securities. They just go to the same people who are buying it, the market makers, to get it. They just confirm that they're not actually doing valuations of these models.
Well, I mean, there is a possibility that everybody's free riding on everybody else.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the usual situation is if you see a nation of freeloaders and free riders out there, somebody can make a killing by doing the valuation that nobody else does. One of the mistakes, for example, in the sort of the pure version of the theory of efficient markets is that it assumes that everybody takes a passive position, that you can still generate prices. The correct argument on this is that if you have people who make investments, they'll get a normal rate of return on their investments through the market, and then others can free ride upon them, and there'll be a constant shift in the equilibrium between the number of free riders and the number of checkers. And the basic theorem on this is the higher the variability with respect to the market, the more there'll be makers and the fewer there'll be on passive side. I think that's right.
Okay, we're going to take one more question, and I'll take it from you in the start.
I was wondering, I thought that short selling actually exacerbated the problem, and I know that it was stopped for a little.
No serious person believes that. The short sellers are responsible for driving the oil prices up from 60 to 147. But on the other hand, they had nothing to do with driving it down from 47 back to 66. Look, the one thing that happens when you get rid of short sellers is that you increase the bid-ask spreads and you reduce the liquidity in the marketplace. I can't believe that this had the slightest thing to do with what's going on. In fact, if you're worried about thin markets and insufficient information, what the short players do is they add additional players in there so they can get greater density and therefore to get a better curve. They did this before the bailout situation, and interestingly enough, they tumbled during that whole period in which the ban on short sales were there. And my view is that probably exacerbated the situation because it reduces the opportunity for midterm correction. That's another one of these classic sort of blunders that can easily take place.
I think I am pro regulation in this area, and yet I think no serious economists and no serious regulators/lawyers think that short selling is a problem. Getting rid of it may have created a sort of positive bias in prices. But what's interesting is the people who said it was a problem are the same people who never wanted to be regulated, and I think that it is reasonable to feel about them the way the proletariat felt about the nobility during the French Revolution.
Yeah.
So communists gets less.
Yeah, no, it doesn't get less. What happens is the thing to understand about a lot of this corporate wealth is the amount of egalitarian stuff that takes place by wiping out all of these executives on Wall Street. This has been real carnage. There are people who's holding the gun from $100 million to $100,000. So that they're actually poor. And some of us who are tenured professors have always said we like the low beta, notwithstanding the low alpha, i.e., we're willing to tolerate our puny salaries because we know they're going to be here anyway. And so that's why Steve and I are sitting here not happy about the current situation, but at least not in a state of personal shock. And you know, the fact that there's some agreement here, I think, should give you all hope that maybe in the larger world, saner views will eventually prevail. Because you can get consensus on what's stupid, even if it's very hard to get consensus on what's obvious.
And on that, I'd like for all of us to thank Richard.